Hi, everyone. This is Candace, and I'm just so glad that you're all here. There are a lot of people who have registered for this call today, and for me, that shows that those of us who have this issue in our lives, we are not alone. You are not alone. And a lot of loved ones really feel like they are alone because they don't talk to other people, some of them, about this. And so they don't really understand that today, unfortunately, in our society, there are so many, many people who are affected by somebody else's addiction. Sometimes they're affected by their own addiction, and sometimes it's both. They're affected by their own and someone else's. It's really hard to find anybody who isn't. The other thing that I really want to say to you is, and we'll talk about this more, but you did not cause your loved one's addiction. And again, many loved ones take on a lot of shame, feeling that they've done something terribly, terribly wrong, and they've caused this to happen. You did not cause this to happen. You may have contributed to it unwittingly without realizing it, but you did not cause it to happen. It is not your fault. So with that, there's a couple of housekeeping things that I wanted to bring to your attention. One is, you may have heard as we were waiting for the call to start that you will all be muted until the end of my presentation and we get into the questions. So for those of you who are wanting to ask a question, when it comes your turn, you will be unmuted. Carol will do that, so you don't have to worry about that. I'd like to introduce Carol, who is my amazing assistant, and she's taking care of all the technological aspects of this, and without her, we wouldn't be here because I couldn't do it myself. So, Carol, can you just say hello?
Hi, everyone. And I just want to answer Tierney's question. There are no slides, so.
Yes, we're keeping it simple this time, Tierney. No slides, maybe next time. But I will talk about the handout and the book and how you might be able to follow along. So I want you to know that I have call waiting on my phone. We didn't realize that this could be an issue until today. There's no way for me to just shut that off. If somebody does call while we're doing this, you might hear a beep. Please don't worry about that. Just disregard it. And also, if you've called in long distance, if there's anybody from not from the Vancouver area, there, or if you've called the long distance number in the Vancouver area, if you press star 5 on your phone, you will be given the local number that you can call in on if you don't want to make a long distance call. So you can just write that number down and hang up and call back in on a local line so you're not paying long distance charges. Now, I think all of you were sent a handout of the 10 tips, and maybe you have that in front of you. For those of you who have a copy of my book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, if you have that with you, I will be quoting from it, and I will be giving you the page numbers as I do that, so you can follow along in the book. And if you have a book but you don't have it with you, or if you don't have a book yet but you plan on getting one, then you might want to just write down the page numbers as I give them to you, and then you can refer back later to what I'm talking about, because I think that would be really helpful for you. You know, I've been a participant on many, many teleclasses in my time, and I've always wondered why the presenters always talk so fast. And I was saying this to somebody yesterday. Now I understand, because there's so much information that I want to give you in about the space of an hour. I do want to be respectful of time. I will do my very best to end my part of the presentation by about 3. I'll do the very best I can, and then we'll have the Q&A after that. But I will do my best to not talk too fast and to not overwhelm you, but I am going to move from thing to thing so that I can impart what I have to give you today. When I talk publicly I usually tell you something about myself. I give my story a little bit and tell you how I got here, that kind of thing. I'm not going to do that today because I simply don't have the time. But there is an About Candace page on my website. Please feel free after the call to go to that and take a look if you haven't, if you don't know much about me. What I will tell you is that I grew up in a family with addiction. And when I talk about addiction, what I'm talking about is any kind of addictive behavior that's become a problem in a person's life. So, you know, I'm definitely, of course, talking about alcohol and drugs. I'm also talking about eating disorders or workaholism or smoking or gambling or compulsive overspending or porn addiction, sex addiction, that kind of codependency, which is what a lot of you are struggling with as loved ones. So I am the loved one of addicts, and I have been in relationships where addiction has been present. So I understand the problems that you have. And I am also an addict myself. You can read more about how that happened to me on the About Candace page, but I am now 26 and I think about a half years clean and sober. And I'm quite proud of that. I've worked hard for that. I've also been an addictions therapist for close to 25 years, so I know addiction and I know this these issues and these problems from a number of different perspectives. And I really wanted you to know about that for me. That and I'm very happy that you're all here to be able to hear maybe some new information from you, maybe some information you've heard before that you'd like to kind of get validated again. And I just think that all of you who are on this call today or listening to the link afterwards, to the recording, are very courageous because this is hard work. It's hard to be in this situation, and I really appreciate that you want to do some things to change it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I also want to let you know that I'm having just a little bit of a throat thing, so you may hear me sucking on a lozenge or clearing my throat, that kind of thing. Just bear with me. Today, what we're going to talk about is learning about the difference between helping and enabling. This is a major keystone in anything that you're going to be able to do to change the situation, to make things better for yourself. The difference between helping and enabling. We're going to be talking about what we can change and what we can't change, another major keystone. And we're going to be talking about how to take better care of ourselves, what we need to do, why it's important. And please remember through all of this that you are not the only ones who are affected. There are millions of people in the world who are affected. So please, you know, whatever shame you can let go of around that, and also that you did not cause this. And we are going to talk about that more. So I'm going to start with page 25 in the book. And this is in the section called Loving Someone with an Addiction, A Life of Chaos. On page 25, I talk about the most common tendencies of people like yourselves who love an addict. And I'm just going to read a few of them to you and see whether whether it impacts you as I read it, whether it relates to you. You are sick and tired of the pain and or abuse in your relationships. You yell at the addicted person in your life, threatening to leave the relationship if the problem behavior doesn't stop. You complain to your friends and family members about this person, even though you know that they don't know how to help you. You protect the addict by making excuses for the behavior. You make appointments with doctors and therapists for your addicted loved one, only to find that the person is unwilling to go. I think you could, a lot of you out there could raise your hand for that one. And I call that working harder than the addict is working. You don't want to work any harder than the addict is working. That's a tip that I haven't gotten in the book, but you don't want to work any harder than the addict is working. So these are some of the common tendencies for loved ones. There's a few more in the book as well. And then on page 27, at the bottom there, I talk about some of the most common emotions that you are undoubtedly feeling in this situation. So here they are: guilt, shame, anger, anxiety, frustration and fear, confusion, powerlessness, hopelessness, depression, desperation, despondency. They don't sound like you're having a good time. This is not an easy thing to deal with. So the fact that you're here today wanting to listen to this and hear about it and make some changes is just heroic on your part. I consider, this is just my opinion, and I know it might be provocative to some of you out there, but I consider addiction to be a choice. And what I mean by that is that I don't think that people sign up to be addicts. I don't think we go and take addiction 101, and I don't think we think to ourselves, gee, that'll be fun to do. Let's be an addict. But once we realize that we have a problem, once addicts realize that there is a problem, and addicts usually realize that there's a problem, they have a problem long before they get help for it, that's where the choice point is, because the choice is to either stay in active addiction or to go into some kind of active recovery. But when we are addicted, we don't have to stay addicted. So if your loved one is still in active addiction or continues to relapse, they are making the choice to do that. Whether this is a disease or not, whether you see addiction as a disease, whether you see, whether you think that it's a genetic component of predisposition or not, whether you think that we learn it in the home, it all of that kind of doesn't matter, because ultimately, bottom line, addiction is a choice that we make. We're either going to face reality or we're not. So you are not responsible for the choice that your addict makes, and you cannot change the choice they make. What you can do is you can make it more and more and more uncomfortable for them to make that choice. That's what this is all about. You can't make them stop, but you can make it really unpleasurable and uncomfortable for them to continue. Okay? And what happens to the loved ones is that they become addicted to the addict's addiction. And that's what's happened to a lot of you, is that, you know, when the addict is doing well, you're doing well. And when the addict isn't doing well, you're not doing so well. And you're on that roller coaster of chaos with the addict. And what needs to happen is for you to come off that roller coaster and pay more attention to yourself. That's kind of a provocative statement too. Like, how can I do that? Why should I do that? I need to make the addict stop. But no, that's really not how it works. And you know, Dr. Phil has a question. Dr. Phil, good old Dr. Phil, has a question that he asks people. He says, how's that been working for you? So some of you will have been trying and trying and trying to get the addict to stop, and it hasn't been working. So I'm going to show you a different way that actually does work. And, you know, we're talking about the Christmas season, and also, you know, when I say Christmas, please understand that I'm talking about the holiday season. I know that there are a lot of different holidays that are celebrated at this time of year, but it's just a figure of speech. So at this holiday season, this is a very difficult time for loved ones. This is probably the hardest time for you. This time and birthdays, probably the hardest time of the year for you. So it's already uncomfortable, but I'm going to be challenging you to allow yourself to become even more uncomfortable in some of the new things that you're going to learn today. So let's go into the first tip. And the first tip, tip number one, is on page 45. And it is come face to face with reality. Because if you don't come face to face with reality, if you're not willing to be in reality, then why should your addicted loved one be in reality? You've got to be that change. And with each tip, I have a quote in the book, and this one is, it's a very simple, profound saying that I wish I could take credit for creating, but I think I heard it in 12-step programs, and it is, if nothing changes, nothing changes. So I can guarantee you that if you listen to this call today and don't make any changes in what you've been doing, nothing will change. Because if nothing changes, nothing changes. And you need to come face to face with the reality that you are dealing with in order to make some changes. If we stay in that kind of place where we're not facing reality, I call that a fantasy space. It's a wishful thinking kind of space, where you're wishing and hoping and praying and wanting your addict to be clean and sober for the holidays. You hope so much that that will happen, and it probably will not happen. And you need to come face to face with that. Fantasy and wishful thinking are childish kinds of behaviors, so we need to not do that. And in the book, on page 49, I have a list of some of the ways that we don't come face to face, that we choose not to do that. So one of them is denial. And that's where you say, oh, nothing's wrong, I'm fine. And rationalizing, where we're making up excuses for what's going on. And I call that doing rational lies. When you're rationalizing, you're telling yourself and maybe other people rational lies. And you really want to stop doing that too. Blaming, that's when you divert the focus of attention onto somebody else. So it's his fault, it's her fault. You know, if you weren't an addict, I'd have a wonderful life. No. Or what they say in AA, it's kind of that classic, they call it the classic joke, but it's not funny. It's, you know, you'd drink too if you had a wife like mine. Well, that's crazy. You know, a person chooses to drink. It doesn't matter what the situation is. We can make a different choice. Self-blaming is a favorite way that loved ones don't come face-to-face with reality. Loved ones like to blame themselves. They like to say, well, I must be a terrible, horrible person to have caused this. I must deserve this. And that's just not true. There's a few others here as well. So when you have a book, you can look at page 49 and 50. Moving into tip number two, which is on page 55, and it's called How to Discover How to Love an Addicted Person and Stay Healthy. And you actually can do that. You can love an addicted person and stay healthy. You can actually have a healthy relationship with an addicted person, but you have to be the healthy one, because the addict isn't going to be until they start making some changes. The thing we need to look at with this tip is the difference between self-esteem and self-respect. And anybody who's heard me talk before or has worked with me as a client has heard me talk a lot about self-respect, because to me, it is the most important thing that we either have or we don't have. And self-esteem is more about how you are in the outside world, like whether you're holding down a job and you're doing okay, you're raising a family, you're doing all right with your life tasks. That you feel good about that, and that's self-esteem. But how you really feel about yourself inside is sometimes a whole different kettle of fish. And the self-respect, that's more important to me. That's about setting appropriate boundaries, about treating yourself with respect, understanding that we teach other people how to treat us, and if we're not treating ourselves with respect, why should anybody else treat us with respect? It's knowing the importance of self-care, of coming off that roller coaster of chaos, of choosing to do that. And so on page 60, there are some questions to ask yourself, such as, am I enjoying my life the way it is today? Do my relationships with others bring me fulfillment? Is the work I do, whether it's paid work or volunteer or you're at home with your children, all of those are very important things to do. Is the work I do satisfying and enriching? Do I have hobbies and activities that I enjoy doing on a regular basis? There's a few more questions here, too. If you're answering no to any of these today, then you need to be looking at your self-respect. You need to be looking at the kind of life that you've created for yourself. And you also, at this time of year, have to look at what you can implement, what you can change to stay healthy during these holidays. And a big part of that is going to be about self-care and respecting yourself enough to take care of yourself. Just getting a sip of water here. Okay, let's move into tip 3, which is on page 65. And tip 3 says, you cannot control or fix another person, so stop trying. This is one of the most important of the 10 tips. You cannot control or fix another person, so stop trying. This is a really difficult one for people to wrap their heads around. But even though it's hard for you to understand this, or it may be, it's still true. And the quote that I have in the book for this tip is my favorite of all. And this is how it goes. Never try to teach a pig to sing. It's a waste of your time, and it annoys the pig. So, you know, if you're wasting all your time trying to get the attic to stop, trying to get the pig to sing, that's not a good thing. We're going to look at what you can do instead, what will work better than that. One of the ways that I help people see what they can change and what they can't change, because that's what this tip is about, is to use the Serenity Prayer. And most of you know the Serenity Prayer if you've been to any 12-step programs or maybe you've just heard it around. But it's, again, it's a very short piece of writing, very profound, and I love it. So I'm going to go through it really quickly with you here. It's on page 69 in the book. So the first line is, God, whatever that means to you, okay? God, grant me the serenity. And serenity is peace and calmness. And if you're the loved one of an addict in active addiction, or maybe even early recovery, you don't have much serenity. So God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. So we need to ask, well, what kinds of things can't I change? Okay, well, you can't change the weather. If it's raining and you want it to be sunny, oh well, you can't change that. You can't change time. Time goes at its own rate, and we grow older, as I well know, and we don't quite know how that happens to us, but there it is, and we can't control that. We can't control anything outside of ourselves. So we cannot control another person either. we sometimes think we can, because if, for example, you say to your addicted partner, if you don't stop using and drinking, I'm leaving. And your partner stops using and drinking. And you think to yourself, got it, I'm controlling him now. But that's not how it works. You've said your boundary, you've put out your truth, and he has made his own choice. He's decided that the consequence of you leaving is not something he wants. And so as a result, he's going to stop using and drinking. That's how it is. This is a planet of free will, and he's made his own choice. But he could have made a different choice. You could have said, if you don't stop, I'm leaving, and he could have continued. It wasn't about you. What you did was you set your boundary, which is what we need to do, and then the choice is theirs. All right? You do not control somebody else. So the next line is, the courage, because it's hard, to change the things I can, because what you can change is you. You can change your choices, your reactions, your beliefs, your attitudes, but it all comes from you. That's all you can change. Whether you want to think so or not, that's it. And maybe for some of you, that's a relief. Maybe you can stop trying so hard to teach the pig to sing. And the last line is, and the wisdom to know the difference. Because I think it's the most important line, because if we don't have the wisdom to know the difference between what we can change and what we can't change, we're going to keep trying to change what we can't change. And it's a useless outpouring of energy. In this holiday season, you need to understand that you don't have control over whether your addicted loved one behaves themselves or not. What you can do is put out boundaries and see what choice they make. Okay? So let's go into tip number four. Tip number four is on page 75. And it says, and this is a hard one for people, stop blaming other people and become willing to look at yourself. Like I said, it's a hard one. You did not cause this addiction, but you very probably have been contributing to it by enabling instead of helping, which we're going to get into in the next tip. And the only thing you can change is you. So what you need to do is become willing to look at yourself. And the quote for this tip is that wonderful one from Gandhi that says that you must be the change you want to see in the world. How about if you role model that for your loved one? How about if you stop trying to get them to change and you start changing yourself? Also in the book, there is a quote from Maya Angelou, who some of you may know her. She's a poet. She's an older woman. She's a mentor of Oprah's. So some of you may have seen her on the Oprah show if you used to watch that show. She's quite amazing. And the quote that I have from her is, if you don't like something in your life, change it. If the situation can't be changed, i.e. if it's about another person or the weather or time or something like that, if the situation can't be changed, then change your attitude about it. Don't complain. So I'll read that again to you. If you don't like something in your life, change it. If the situation can't be changed, then change your attitude about it. Don't complain. Right? Harsh but wonderful words from Maya. Tip number five. Yes, another one of the hallmarks of this work. It's on page 85, and it's learn the difference between helping and enabling. And if you're on this call, then you probably have heard the word enabling. You may already know that you do some of it. I'm going to give you just a few quick, simple definitions. An enabling behavior is something that keeps the addiction going. So that would be something like giving money to an addict. You don't give money to an addict. Don't give money to an addict. It keeps the addiction going. Don't drive your alcoholic loved one to the liquor store. Don't do that kind of stuff. It keeps the addiction going. And helping behaviors, excuse me, are those that assist the addiction to stop. And that's about setting your boundaries, setting healthy boundaries. We'll talk more about how to do that in just a minute. I'm also going to give you a definition for codependency, because that's a buzzword in our field, codependency. And I also use the term people pleaser. I use them alternatively, codependence and people pleasers. And if you're a codependent or a people pleaser, if you already know that, raise your hand. I can just see some hands going up. And I am a recovering codependent people pleaser. A codependent person is somebody who puts other people's needs ahead of his own or her own on a fairly consistent basis. And the question we need to ask is, why are we doing this? And whose needs are being met by doing this? People who are loved ones are invariably codependent. Most of you are people pleasers. And a people pleaser hates conflict. A people pleaser will try to avoid conflict at any cost. They do not like it when other people get mad at them. They don't know how to handle it. And I can understand that. I used to feel the same way, and nobody ever taught me how to handle anger, other people's anger, and probably nobody taught you either. And the key is that when we can learn how to deal with somebody else throwing their anger at us or their frustration or their disappointment, then we are free. We are emotionally free to be ourselves, and we don't have to people please anymore. But if you think about it, the reason a people pleaser pleases other people is not so much that they are nice people. People pleasers, like, you know, we like to think of ourselves as such nice people, you know, the finger in the cheek. Oh, I'm so nice, right? Why does everybody treat me so badly? But that's not really how it is. I'm not saying you're not nice people, because you are, and I am most of the time. But we're not that nice, and that's not why we're doing it. We're doing it because we are trying to protect ourselves from other people getting angry with us. So whose need is being met here? When we are codependent, when we are enabling an addict, when we are letting addicts get away with absolutely atrocious, untoward behavior, whose need are you meeting? You're not meeting their need. They may want to continue their addiction. They may want to get away with that behavior, but that's not what they need. What they need is to stop doing that. What they need is to heal from that. But the need that's being met actually is your need to avoid conflict. So I ask you to think about that. I ask you to consider that and to be courageous enough to look at that. That's a hard one. And remember that if nothing changes, nothing changes. If you don't start doing things differently, nothing will change. And also remembering that we teach other people how to treat us. So when we start doing things differently, when we start respecting ourselves, other people start to respect us too. It's been a really long time since I've been disrespected, because I respect myself. That hasn't always been the case. So I'm here to tell you that that actually can happen, and it really does work. I want to talk to you a little bit about boundaries right now. boundaries are often hard for loved ones to set because addicts don't like hearing no. They don't like hearing the word no, and they can become quite belligerent and angry, and it can be scary, and that's true. But the alternative of allowing them to get away with that on a consistent basis, I think, is worse. So when we set boundaries, it's a three-part process. And the first part is knowing what your boundary is, because in the same situation, my boundary and your boundary might be different. And that's okay. So we need to know what we can live with, what we can maintain, what's our boundary here. The second part of setting a boundary is knowing how to say that assertively. Because a lot of people say to me, well, how do I say that to him? What do I say to her? I can't. I don't know. I don't even know where to start. And that's totally understandable. If you need help knowing what your boundary is, if you need help learning how to state your boundaries assertively, please reach out for help. There are people like myself and others who can help you with this. It's really important that you learn how to do this. And the third part of setting a boundary is maintaining the boundary. If you're not going to maintain a boundary that you set, don't even bother setting it. Because if you cave, you've probably caved before. You've probably set boundaries before that you haven't maintained. And if you do that, the addict will just keep poking at you and keep testing you and pushing you until you cave, because he knows you will. When I say he, I mean she as well. But he knows you will eventually cave. You need to learn how to maintain those boundaries as well. So let's say, I'm going to use an example that is probably pretty benign. I know that a lot of you are dealing with much, much harsher situations, but I'm going to use a generic kind of example. For the holiday season, let's say you've got Uncle Joe coming to your dinner, and Uncle Joe has historically come to your dinner and gotten drunk at your table and just been a pig, really messed up and untoward and inappropriate. And you've invited Uncle Joe again. What can you do? Well, first of all, you can think about inviting Uncle Joe, maybe not inviting Uncle Joe. You could do that, and that would be okay if you made that choice. Whoever the addict is in your life, you don't have to have him there at your dinner table. But if you do, you can say to Uncle Joe, Uncle Joe, we love you, and we want you to be at our table. We want you to come to our celebration, but we will not tolerate you getting drunk in our home. So we want you to know that ahead of time. And if you do come, we'd love you to come. If you do decide to come under those conditions and you come and you do get drunk, we are going to ask you to leave. What we'll do is we'll take your keys and we'll put you in a cab and off you'll go. So if that's okay with you and you would like to come to our dinner, hopefully you can stay sober. If you don't stay sober, that's what will happen, right? And you set this boundary and you explain to Uncle Joe, and Uncle Joe has a choice of what he's going to do, and you've said it beforehand so you're not worried about it. And then when Uncle Joe gets there, if he gets drunk, which he may well do, you may maintain that boundary, you get his car keys, you call a cab, and you put him in a cab, and off he goes. And I can pretty much guarantee you that if Uncle Joe comes to your house the next year, if you choose to invite him, things will be different. Things will very likely be different. Because Uncle Joe has been held accountable, and addicts do not like to be held accountable, but it's what we need to do, right? So boundaries, knowing your boundary, knowing how to state your boundary, and maintaining your boundary. This is the difference between helping and enabling. And actually, the most loving thing you can do for Uncle Joe is to say, we will not put up with this. We love you, but we will not watch this. We will not participate in this anymore. Sometimes people say, well, that's just tough love. And I say, yeah, it is tough love, but tough love is love. And it's much more loving, as far as I'm concerned, than letting people get away with what they shouldn't be allowed to get away with. So moving on to tip number 6, which is on page 97. Don't give in to manipulation. Now, as you all know, I know it too, and I can remember being this way when I was in my addiction so many years ago. Addicts are incredibly manipulative. We want what we want, and we'll do what we need to do to get it. We'll do whatever people will give us the leeway to do. So you need to be able to come out of your comfort zone about not wanting conflict and be able to say no to an addict. And if you can't do this, nothing will change. Or if you choose to not do this, nothing will change, because you can do it. It's just that you're going to be uncomfortable. But, you know, you're asking the addict in your life to be uncomfortable. You're asking the addict to make some uncomfortable changes. Addicts are scared to give up their addictive behaviors, and you're asking them to do that. I'm challenging you to give up some of yours. The quote in my book for this tip is from Nietzsche, who he came up with some very wise sayings, and here's his. He says, "No price is too high to pay for the privilege of owning yourself. No price is too high to pay for the privilege of owning yourself." So we'll move on to tip number 7. Tip number 7 is on page 105, and it's ask yourself the magic question. I don't know if you've heard the magic question before, but the magic question is, what would my life be like if this wasn't in it, if I didn't have this problem? What would my life be like? The quote for this one, I really like it. Worrying, which is something that all loved ones of addicts do on a constant basis, worrying is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but it doesn't get you anywhere. So when you're thinking about the holiday season, when you're looking at Christmas, you need to be looking at, how would my life be different if I was different? How would my Christmas be different? How would my holiday season be different if I was able to do some of these things that we're talking about today? On page 110, under the section, How the Magic Question Can Help You, you can ask yourself, how would my life be better if I wasn't consumed by behaviors that enable my loved one? What would I have time to do for myself in my own life if I wasn't constantly focused on the addict? And I invite you to be thinking about those things. So ask yourself the magic question, how can I make this different? How can I make this year different? So tip number 8, this is another really, really important one. I think all the tips are important, but I think, you know, there are a few that are more important than others, and this one is one of them. Know that self-care does not equal selfish. Another hard one to wrap your heads around, because when you are a loved one of an addict and you're a people pleaser and you're codependently putting other people's needs ahead of your own, you're going to be looking at your own needs and feel like you're selfish, like you're guilty if you take care of yourself. So the difference between selfish and self-caring, you know, self-caring is when we respect ourselves enough to take care of ourselves. Selfish is, I want what I want when I want it right now, I'm going to step on whoever I have to get it. And who does that sound like? To me, that sounds a lot more like the addict than it does the loved one. So I invite you to look at self-care differently. The analogy I really like to use, many of you have heard me use it, is when you're in an airplane and the flight attendant comes on and says, you know, if we hit the dreaded turbulence, the masks are going to fall, and whose mask do they tell you to put on first? Well, they always tell you to put your own mask on first. Even if you're with a little child, a young child who can't put his own, he's fumbling with his own mask, you're maybe with somebody who's older or sick or disabled, you still put your own mask on first. And the way I look at this is that if you can't breathe, how can you help anybody else breathe? So you need to be taking care of yourself first, and with that energy, be giving back to other people. Loved ones often do it backwards. They're taking care of everybody else until they're depleted, and then they say, well, I don't have any more energy for myself. It doesn't work that way. How has it been working for you? So start taking care of yourself first, and then with whatever energy you have after that, take care of other people. And be a role model for that in your family. Be a role model for that with your addicted loved one that you're now looking after yourself. And it's up to them whether they want to look after themselves or not. On page 117, I have what I've developed as the People Pleasers Creed and the Self-Care Creed. So the People Pleasers Creed is, I must never, never, ever hurt another person's feelings. That's what codependents tell themselves. That's what people pleasers tell themselves, and often loved ones of addicts tell themselves, I can't say no to you because then your feelings will be hurt. But really what it is your feelings will be hurt and you won't like me and you'll be angry with me. And that's really what's going on. So the people pleaser is saying, I can never hurt another person's feelings because they don't want conflict. The self-care creed, which is on page 119, is, although I care about other people's feelings, the way I feel about myself is more important to me. So although I care about other people's feelings, the way I feel about myself, actually the way I have it written here, the way I feel about myself is most important to me. And I think that's the way it needs to be. How you feel about yourself, your self-respect, is the most important thing you have or don't have. And the only way to get it, you can't go buy it at 7-Eleven. The only way to get it is to do the next right thing and the next right thing after that. To do the things that give you self-respect and to not do the things that don't. Now, around the holidays, you need to ramp up your self-care. You absolutely need to ramp up your self-care. Self-care is about, it's holistic. So it's about emotional, physical, mental, spiritual. So with physical, you know, I kind of hate to tell you, but you really are what you eat. How you take care of yourself physically really says a lot about you, what you put into your body, how you adorn your body, how you dress, how you take care of your hygiene. All of that matters, and all of that says something about you. Whether you exercise your body, all of that says something about how you feel about yourself. Emotionally, there's this wonderful acronym from 12-step programs again called HALT, H-A-L-T. I have this in the book. HALT stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired. So if you're feeling a little off, just stop, halt, just look within. Am I hungry? Do I need a snack? And hopefully it'll be a healthy snack and not a chocolate bar like I would like to go to, but try not to. But, you know, giving yourself an apple, giving yourself something, you know, three good meals a day kind of thing. Are you angry? Are you scared or sad, or, you know, is there something you need to talk about because something emotionally has come up for you? Are you lonely? You know, do you need to call your best friend and go have a play date? Do you need to maybe tell your husband that you want to have a date with him without the kids? Are you lonely? Are you tired? Do you need a nap, or are you not getting enough rest? Are you not sleeping? Do you need to maybe go to a doctor or a naturopath and find out what that's about and maybe get some supplements that are healthy, that aren't addictive, to help you sleep? Right? Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Wonderful gauge. Mentally, you want to keep yourself sharp, especially as you grow older. I like to tell people that I study Korean, which I do, and that's a whole, you know, different language with a whole different sentence structure and alphabet, and it keeps me really sharp. And we need to do that for ourselves. And spiritually, you know, that means different things to different people. For some people, it means religion. It means church or temple or mosque. For other people, it means going for a walk in nature with your dog. Whatever it means for you, find out. Figure out what it is and do more of it. Do as much of it as you can to give you that wonderful feeling of serenity within you. We all know what that feels like, but we want to know it more. Around the holidays, in terms of self-care, I'm going to challenge all of you, because probably most, if not all of you, have some perfectionistic tendencies, maybe, you think? So it's okay if, for example, your Christmas tree doesn't look exactly like you'd like it to look. And it's okay if your table isn't set exactly right. I'm suggesting that you delegate some of the things that you have to do. If you're having a busy season, delegate some of the things you have to do. Instead of thinking to yourself, well, I have to do everything, because if I don't do it, it won't get done right. And I can see some of you chuckling when I say that. So delegate and lower your bar of expectation for that. I think you'll be a lot happier. Or you might want to look at doing less. So this holiday season, make a list of how you can ramp up your self-care. Make a list and check it twice and make sure you're doing some stuff that's good for you, okay? Really important. Okay, tip number 9 is on page 137. That's called Rebuild Your Life. And, you know, this is the perfect chance to do this. This is the courage to change the things you can. Look at what you might like to do. A lot of times loved ones of addicts have spent so much energy on the addict that they have no idea what they would even like to do. They have no idea who they are. So what are some of your interests? What are some of your dreams, your goals? What would you like to do? You know, have you taken that pottery class or that Zumba class? Would you maybe like to go to Al-Anon or maybe an affected others group like Tierney runs? You know, would you like to find some other like-minded people and do some things that would be good for you? Maybe get a trainer, maybe reconnect with some old friends that you haven't seen during this holiday season. So, you know, baby steps. You need to take some baby steps to start rebuilding your life. You've been on that roller coaster and you need to come off and do it differently. Tip number 10 is on page 155. And tip number 10 is, don't wait until the situation is really bad. Reach out for help now. And that's what you're doing by being on this call. In fact, I just want to validate you so much. If you haven't had the opportunity to work with me as a client, I'm going to teach you right now how to pat yourself on the back, just even for being on this call today. So I'd like you to put your arm out, kind of Nazi style, and then turn your palm up, If you're not doing it, do it. Put your arm out, turn your palm up, and then reach behind and pat yourself on the back. Because so often loved ones never do. You never validate yourself for what you are doing right. Start doing that. In fact, I give that to you for homework every single day. Pat yourself on the back for whatever you can about what you're doing well in your lives, what you're doing good for yourself. All right? One of the things that you really might want to think about doing is getting a therapist for yourself, just even for a few sessions. It's not like, you know, you don't have to go for a long time, but maybe for a few sessions, just to look at what it is about you that makes you a people pleaser. See if you can come to the roots of that so that you can heal it. Maybe it started in your family of origin. Maybe you've got some stuff that's, you know, that's still pretty traumatic for you that you need to work out. It's such important work to do, and it's so rewarding. It's such an amazing journey to get to know ourselves. So if you're interested in seeking out some help for yourself therapeutically, on page 162 and 3, I have some questions that you can ask, some things to look at about choosing a therapist, because, frankly, all therapists are not created equal, and you want to find somebody who is healing themselves. You want to find somebody who's doing this work themselves so that they really know how to help you do it. So there are some checkpoints and guidelines here for you in the book about that. And there are other avenues of support for you as well. There are religious and spiritual communities. You know, again, there's Al-Anon or Affected Others groups. That's what they're called now. They're Affected Others. You are now called an Affected Other as well as a loved one. So you can be looking into whether you've got those in your community. And if you don't, you could start one, because you're not the only one affected by this in your community. Absolutely guaranteed. There are other, you may have friends, and you may have other family members that you might be able to talk to and get some support from. Now, sometimes people say to me, but I don't know what to share. I don't know how much to share, and I don't know who to share it with. I don't know how to trust people. So the analogy I use is if you already know that somebody's going to judge you, don't bother sharing with them. Just trust your instinct on that and don't bother. But if you're not sure and you think that you might be able to get support from somebody, then put your big toe in the water and maybe tell them something small. Maybe something like, I mean, it might feel big to you, but something small like, you know, I think my son might be smoking some pot. And if that person says, oh, no, oh, that's horrible, that's terrible, you might not want to tell them much more. Or if they judge you and they say, well, how could you let that happen? You don't tell them anything more. You've put your big toe in. You've tested it out. Not a good thing. But if they say to you, oh, wow, boy, that sounds like it could be difficult. What are you doing about that? Tell me more. Then you might want to put the ball of your foot in the water. Or the person might say, you know what? My daughter's smoking pot too. Or I know somebody else who's dealing with this problem. If you get that kind of response, then you put the ball of your foot in the water, and then if you keep talking, you put your ankle in the water, and you learn how to trust incrementally, you know, slowly. You learn how to trust somebody and trust your own gut with this. Don't just blah, tell everybody everything. That's not a good thing either. So learn how to get support for yourself. Remember that you are not the only one affected by this, that you didn't cause it, but that there are things that you need to change, and especially around your holiday season, let your challenge be, how can I make this better this year? What can I do to make this better? And, oh, my goodness, it's right around 3 o'clock, and I'm finished. I think I've told you everything that I wanted to tell you. So, Carol, I'm going to ask you about the questions, and if you can unmute people, and let's get that started. And before we do, I want to say I know that some of you only booked off 2 to 3 to be able to be here, you know, this 1 hour. If you have to go, I totally understand, and you can hear the question and answer section on the tape if you want to, or please feel free to stay if you can. And thank you very much for being here.
Okay, I have Dale in Toronto. You have a question?
Hi, Dale.
Hi. I don't have a question. I was raising my hand when Candace asked earlier. But thank you so much.
When I asked if, what, a viewer, a people pleaser or something like that?
If I was a people pleaser, I was putting my hand up.
You put your hand up. Okay.
Thank you so much for this call. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Next. Carol?
I'm not seeing any questions right now.
Okay. Let's give people a moment and see if they have any questions. We'll just wait a minute.
Earlier, someone asked, Kathy asked about, will you deal with going to Christmas parties where people are offering drinks and more drinks?
Yes. So if you have, Kathy, are you there on the line? Or?
No, she's on the Internet.
On the Internet. Okay, Kathy. So I'm assuming that what you're asking is something like, you know, if you have a partner or maybe an adult child who's been drinking and you want to, you're going to be going to parties with them and alcohol will be there, how do you handle yourself with that? And I think, first of all, if you've got a partner, if you've got somebody in your life who's been drinking and you're not so much of a drinker, I think it would be great if you could just not drink and support your loved one that way and talk about this before you go to these functions. But let that person know. Let them know. I'm not going to drink. I want to support you in not drinking. And if you find it really difficult to be there with alcohol there, then I'm really okay to come home. Or if you don't want to go because you're afraid that you might drink, I'm really okay to stay home with you. Like, I just want to be able to support you to stay healthy. But I guess the other part of the question could be, you know, if you're with somebody who is still in active addiction and is drinking and you're thinking you're going to go to a party and that person is going to drink and drink and drink and get drunk at the party, you might want to set a boundary before you go. And you might decide not to even go. You might say to that person, you know what, I'm not comfortable going to these with you anymore. I don't want to be in this position. I'm respecting myself enough to not put myself in this position. So if you want to go, I'm taking your car keys. You're going to have to take a cab and find a way home that, you know, where you're not driving. So those would be the kinds of things that I would suggest. You can't make them not drink, but you can make it more difficult for them. But if you're with somebody who is trying not to drink, support them to the best of your ability. Okay. Is there another question?
Yes. T. Phipp in...
That's Crystal.
Crystal, yeah, hi.
Crystal.
Can you hear me?
I can. What's your question?
Great. Okay, I'm... this is sort of regarding the Christmas drinking with my adult daughter, who was not drinking and has gone back to drinking, social drinking, she says. I have made a conscious decision that if we're having a Christmas do here at my house, I don't want her to drink. My other children are having a hard time with this. They are kind of saying, she's the one that screwed up. Why are you penalizing us?
How are you penalizing them? Are you saying that you don't want anybody drinking in your home?
What I've said, I don't want anyone drinking. And I guess that is the dilemma. Is it, you know, why am I being so hardline about it? I've just felt really uncomfortable around her, knowing that she's drinking again after what she's, you know, what we've all gone through in the last couple of years. So I have also, my father's an alcoholic, and I've already gone through this once as a child, and and I have really set my boundaries that, no, I don't want you drinking in my house.
Mm-hmm.
But the other two kids have, you know, adults have said, well, that's not fair. And so my son has basically said, well, then I don't think we should bother doing this. Forget it. You know, we're trying to combine a birthday for him and a Christmas dinner. And I was going to do one event. And he said, forget it. I don't want to do it. So I'm feeling guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I should be. I feel like I've set my boundaries.
Okay.
And I just don't know, is it better to say, no, you can't drink in my house, even though I know she's drinking at, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of Christmas events this week, I know, and I'm worried, but it's nothing I can do about that.
Right. So maybe you can follow what I was saying about good old Uncle Joe.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that. So talk.
Because when people are alcoholic, I've had many, many clients who have tried to control their drinking and have tried to go from addictive drinking to social drinking, and it only works for a short period of time because you know, there's a somewhat of an allergy to the substance, and addiction is a progressive disease, or I shouldn't say disease, it's a progressive condition, and it just gets worse and worse, and it blows out of proportion. So the chances are pretty good that if she's doing social drinking, the time's going to come fairly soon when she's going to get drunk.
Yeah.
And what you can say to her, this is one way to handle it. I mean, you know, the choice is yours, of course. But one way to handle it is to be having alcohol in your home if she's the only one that that you're concerned about. And to say to her, if you get drunk, we will ask you to leave. You will not be welcome here. So if you get drunk, we will take your keys away from you, and we will put you in a cab and send you home.
So you think that's a better way of doing it, to still have alcohol at home rather than just saying no to everybody?
Crystal, if she was saying to you, I don't want to drink, and I'm afraid that if there's alcohol here, I'm going to drink, I would have a different answer for you.
She's going to drink.
No. Listen to what I'm saying. If she was coming to you, saying to you, I don't want to drink, I want to stay sober, but I'm afraid that if I come to some place that has alcohol in it, like your home, I will drink. I'm afraid of that.
Right.
Then I would be saying to you, maybe not have alcohol there. But what she's saying to you is, no, I can handle it. I can do it. I can drink. And your other adult children are saying, we want to be able to have a drink too.
Uh-huh.
It's not a problem for us. And we've been through the ringer with her.
Uh-huh. That's exactly
what I said. So what you can say to her is, all right, if you can nurse 1-2 drinks for the whole evening, that's fine. But if you get tipsy, if you get drunk, we are going to send you home in a cab. And just for you to know that, you will not be welcomed in our home if you drink, if you get drunk.
All right. Okay. So it's my issue then that I'm uncomfortable being around her with drinking.
Yeah. And if you're not, it's your home. If you're not, you can say to her, I'm not comfortable having you here if you're drinking. So you have a choice to make.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what I'm having a hard time with, is letting go of that and saying, you know, it should be okay for everyone else to be in a situation where we can all have a drink and not feel like we have juice.
Crystal, do you hear the difference of what I'm saying, that if she was trying to stay sober, you would support her in a different way?
Because she's already choosing to be in an addiction.
She's already choosing to wait for addiction to catch up with her again.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you can say, if it catches up to you in my house, you're out of here.
You're out of here. Okay, that sounds good. I have another question. Can I ask another one?
Sure.
Okay. We have been dealing with inheritance money. We've had my mother-in-law has died, and we're dealing with how to give inheritances to the kids. I'm very nervous about giving some money to my daughter, and how do we set this up when two out of three kids are okay and will have inheritances? But at this stage, I'm not comfortable saying to my addicted daughter, here's a lump sum of money.
Right, good. I'm glad you're questioning that. The first answer that comes to my mind is, you know, your other two children are not addicts, I'm assuming, are not addicts.
No.
So they can handle having some money. I'm assuming they're not compulsive overspenders or...
No.
You know, okay, so they can handle having a piece of an inheritance. Your daughter has... If she's been in active addiction for a while, then she has breached your trust over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can say to her, if you choose to, is you can say, you need to rebuild your trust with us. We don't trust you right now. We don't trust you with addiction. We don't trust you with money. We love you, but we don't trust you. So what we're going to do is we're going to hold this money for you. We'll give you a little bit, you know, so you can maybe buy yourself a couple of nice things. But we're not going to give you a whole lump sum of money because we don't trust what you'll spend it on. And we love you so much that we don't want you, you know, to overdose on anything.
Right.
So we're going to hold it for you. And, you know, when you've been clean and sober for a year, then, you know, or 6 months or whatever kind of thing you want to set, then, you know, or if you go to treatment,
right,
we'll reconsider this. But you need to rebuild your trust with us because we don't trust you right now.
Right, right. Yeah, I thought that's what it was going to happen. We're just trying to sort this out. How do we put it into a trust? Because that's what we need to do.
This is your child, and you need to keep her safe to the best of your ability. You can't make her do anything, but you can set some guidelines, and you can keep it you can make it more uncomfortable for her to be in her addiction. Right now, she's probably in some denial, I would imagine.
Yes.
But probably addiction will continue to haunt her. And, you know, I make the decision personally to stay clean and sober every single day. I've been doing that for more than 26 years because I don't want addiction to get me. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe I could have a glass of wine at dinner. Maybe I could smoke a joint at a party. But I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I stay clean and sober, you know. And until she's ready to make a decision like that, for you to give her a lump sum of money could be very dangerous and disastrous for her.
Right.
So I would, you know, have a boundary with that. And if she doesn't like it, oh, well.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Thank you. She has been in treatment a couple of years ago for 5 months, just chosen now to be a social drinker.
And sometimes people need to go to treatment more than once.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
I've heard that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We just need to keep hearing this over and over and over again, I think.
Do you have a copy of the book? Because if you don't, you know, you might want to get it and read it.
Definitely.
Okay.
My neighbors.
Yes, your neighbors.
Okay.
Carol, are there other questions?
Yes, there are. Let me just read them. So Shelley asked, just wondering if anyone has tips for living with an 18-year-old with addiction who has made some changes but is still using. In the new year, do I assist her to get her own apartment?
Well, hello, Shelley. You know, an 18-year-old chronologically is probably like a 15-year-old but is an adult. And this is your house. And you have the right to decide what you're going to put up with and what you're not going to put up with. And so if you're allowing your 18-year-old daughter to use in your home or to come home high, maybe she's not using in your home, but she's coming home high, however it is, you might want to rethink that. Whose need are you meeting here? That's not good for her. I think she needs to probably, if she's not going to respect your home, then she needs to be on her own and see how that is for her. It's probably not going to be so great, you know, and maybe if she decides to come back to your place, she'll respect it a bit more. But it's up to you to set that boundary. I don't think you're doing her a whole lot of favors by allowing her to stay in your home at the age of 18 and have inappropriate and be doing inappropriate behaviors there. So that's my answer.
Okay, the next question is from Tim. He asks, when you say make it uncomfortable, how can parents do this for a teen addict other than to take away money and cell phone, etc.? What are some of the out-of-the-box ways to create consequences for a 16 to 17-year-old living at home?
Well, that's a really good question in terms of out-of-the-box solutions. You know, it's up to you, I think, to figure out what consequence would be meaningful for your child, because that's what you have to work with. And absolutely, if your 16, 17-year-old teen is going to be using in your home and spending money on drugs, I would say don't do anything that gives him money. Don't do anything that, what am I trying to say? Don't do anything that, don't pay for anything. You know, if he wants a cell phone, let him use his money, however he's getting it, let him use his own money to pay for that. He'll have less money for drugs. You know, you might want to say to him, look, if you're gonna live here, because at 16 or 17 they can leave, and there are halfway houses, there are places where kids can go. You know, if you're gonna stay here, then you need to start contributing to the household. So we're not gonna tolerate you using money for drugs when you can be contributing to food and maybe some of the mortgage here. If you're going to live here, then you need to be participating as part of the family. But I you know, the out-of-the-box things are going to come from what's important for your son, what's important for him. What if you take it away, what's it going to mean to him? You know, if you tell a five-year-old, go clean your room, and the kid won't go clean his room, and you say to him, okay, well, you can't watch TV with us later then, and he doesn't care about being able to watch TV with you later, he's not going to clean his room. You know, but if you say to him, you know, you can't have ice cream after dinner, and maybe that means something to him, he's going to go clean his room. So I think the out of the box solutions have to come from you knowing what's going to make a dent in your son, what's going to make it uncomfortable for him. But, you know, don't allow him to do the things that he's doing and stay in your home. It's really not okay. It's not a good thing for him. It's not a loving thing toward him. You're preparing him for a world out there that does not exist. The world will not tolerate this behavior from him. So I ask you to think about that. Okay, any more?
Yes. Donalda asked, how do you suggest dealing with fear of the call that your adult child has overdosed? We are trying to maintain boundaries as he has repeatedly gone through treatment and chosen to reuse. However, as a mom, I find myself struggling with the fear of that call.
Okay, can you just read that to me again, please, Carol?
Sure. How do you suggest dealing with fear of the call that your adult child has overdosed? We are trying to maintain boundaries as he has repeatedly gone through treatment and chosen to reuse. Mm-hmm. However, as a mom, I find myself struggling with the fear of that call.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that you're going to be able to do much about having the fear of that call. If you have a child, an adult child who is, any kind of child who is choosing to relapse, then that call could come. And I don't have a magic wand. I wish I did. I'd use it on me too. You know, I can't take that fear away from you, and I think it's a legitimate fear for you to have. But what I would suggest is that you also be living your own life even while you're in fear of that, because that call may not come, and let's hope it doesn't, but that call might not come. And here you are, perhaps, you know, being in so much fear of that call that you're obsessively worrying about that, and you're not taking care of your own life. And I really suggest you take care of your own life. Your addict is choosing to relapse. It's a choice that he or she can make. You can't stop it. But what you can do is you can role model different behaviors, and you could actually name that for your child if you wanted to. You could say, you know, I'm worried about that call coming in, and that would be devastating for me if that happened. But I'll tell you, in the meantime, I'm going to start living my own life, and you're going to watch me do that. I'm a big proponent of naming things. It makes it harder for people to play their games when the game has been named. So I can't take the fear away from you. I know that you know that I can't. I know you're not asking me to, but I think what I'm really trying to say is, you know, cut yourself some slack with this because it's an appropriate fear to have. It could happen. But don't get so stuck in it that you can't be living your own life and taking good or better care of yourself. Okay. Well, I think we have some time for another one.
Diana asks, with our son being an addict, he is currently at LDR Center turning his life around. He chose this with our support. My question, how do we deal with choices our son will now make towards family members, meaning he may choose not to have anything to do with them, but when we have a family gathering, what do we do? We feel like we are caught in the middle.
Okay, so this is one from the internet. This is a person I can't talk voice to voice with. So so I think what you're saying, hopefully I'm getting it right, that what you're saying is that your son may be making some decisions to not have something to do with other family members, and that you're thinking, should I have them over to the house when he's there, kind of thing. I would say that if he's making the choice to not have contact with people and you want to have contact with those people, then he's going to have to learn how to deal with not having contact with those people. So he can either be there during those times, or he can learn how to be in the same room and not communicate very much with them. If he's at LDR, LDR is a great place, and if he's at LDR, then I think this is a great question for him to be bringing up to the counselors while he's there. And if he has left LDR by now, then you know, he can call them and he can talk to them, because they do aftercare there, and he can talk about that, because that's actually his problem to solve. That's actually not yours to solve. And in the very beginning of the call, I talked about not working harder than an addict will work. So this is not really your problem, and you don't have to see yourself stuck in the middle. If the people he doesn't want to communicate with are okay people, then there's no problem in you having them over. And if he wants to be there, he can be there or not. Or he can learn how to be in situations where there are people that he doesn't really like all that much. Welcome to the world. But there are people at LDR who will help him deal with that kind of life issue question. And I think it's a really good one. But it's not yours to solve.
Okay, there's one more question, a caller.
One, yeah.
A caller, Stephen in Vancouver. Go ahead.
Well, my name is Kaisa. Is it Kaisa?
Kaisa?
Yes.
It
could be. We have a Steve and Kaisa on this telephone line.
Okay. Kaisa, hello.
If it's me, hello.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is this. It pertains to something you said in your talk about even in early recovery, we may not have much serenity. And that was something I wrote down when you were giving your talk, because in 2 days from now, my adult sister will be leaving treatment and joining us for all of the holiday festivities and family events, and the family does have some apprehension and concerns about walking on eggshells so around her. And so what you said there made me want to ask if you could describe that in a little bit more detail.
So I think what really needs to happen is that boundaries need to be set, and they might not need to be set before she comes home. That depends on you as a family. But as behaviors that are inappropriate start to come to the surface, the boundaries need to be set there. And you need to be a united front. And family members sometimes have difficulty doing that, because some family members will allow more you know, crap, so to speak, to happen than others will. And so sometimes this is a difficult thing. But the more united you guys can be about what you'll allow and what you won't allow, and maybe having a discussion about that before she comes home with each other, and maybe I can help you with that, you know, would be a good idea. What do you anticipate could happen? Those kinds of questions. But the boundaries, it's all about self-respect and boundaries and teaching her how to treat you. Because walking on eggshells is not the answer. It just isn't. If you've been walking on eggshells with her and you keep walking on eggshells with her, nothing will change. Because nothing's changing, nothing changes. Right?
Yep.
So I think maybe that's something that we can discuss a little bit more.
That sounds good.
But it's a really good question because, you know, sometimes people who are in really early recovery, even if they're not drinking and using, they're still exhibiting these really inappropriate behaviors until they learn not to. But the only way they learn not to is to not be allowed to do it. You're not doing her any favors by allowing her to be able to get away with this. It's not a loving act. And again, I would ask you, whose needs are being met by you guys walking on eggshells? Not hers. What she needs is when she pushes against you, you don't cave. When she pushes against you with this behavior, you stand there firmly and say no. That's what she needs. It's not what she wants, but it is what she needs. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Is that the end of the questions, Carol?
Yes, no more questions.
Wow, our timing was great because it's just 3:30. Thank you, everyone. Fantastic questions, and I hope that this has been helpful to all of you. And you will be getting a link so that you can download a recording of this call and of the questions and answers. And if you do have somebody that you'd like to send it to if you have somebody you'd like to share the link with, please feel free to do that. So I think we can end the call now, Carol, however we do that. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.